I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Early voting in the Maryland primary begins Thursday. Election Day is in 2 weeks. Compared with citizens in other advanced democracies, why do so few Americans vote, particularly in midterm elections? One reason, barriers at the ballot box. In the last few years, 23 states have enacted new laws that make voting more difficult. If there were political will to do so, and that's a big if, what could be done to make it easier? Plus, how secure is voting? Can we trust that our election systems are able to fend off attempts to hack them? Marcia Johnson Blanco from the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law, Max Feldman of the Brennan Center for Justice, John Willis from the University of Baltimore, and Nike Robinson from Black Girls Vote join me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Maryland's primary election is 2 weeks from today. Early voting begins on Thursday. Americans vote at much lower rates than citizens of other advanced democracies. And while voting is the central tenet in a strong democracy, many states have enacted laws and voter requirements in recent years that actually make it harder to vote. So what can be done to encourage and enable voting? And is there the political will to get it done? Later in the show, I'll be joined by Max Feldman from the Brennan Center for Justice in New York, former Maryland Secretary of State John Willis, and Nike Robinson. She's the founder of the Baltimore-based group Black Girls Vote. But first, Marcia Johnson Blanco joins me on the line from Washington. She's the co-director of the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Ms. Johnson Blanco, thanks for your time. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
What do you see as the biggest challenges in this midterm election cycle here in 2018, given what we experienced in 2016, given the laws that I alluded to that have been put into effect over the last, 4 to 8 years?
Well, I would say, given the Supreme Court's decision yesterday, making it harder to stay on the rolls, we really need to look at access to the ballot and voter registration. There are many millions who are not registered to vote, and now those who are registered to vote have to be extra vigilant to make sure that they stay on the rolls, given that yesterday the Supreme Court said that it's permissible for states to start removing voters from the voting rolls just for not voting.
This is the case in Ohio, and if you miss an election or two, you get sent a card that says, are you still in the state of Ohio? Are you still interested in remaining a registered voter? And if they get no response, they can purge your name from the list. Ohio is thought to be pretty aggressive, perhaps the most aggressive state when it comes to purging voter rolls. Are there any other states, any other instances of states, actively trying to decrease the number of people that are on their rolls?
Yes. So Georgia is a state that uses what they call an exact match process. And this is a procedure that we successfully litigated against, where if there is any information on your voter registration form that is different from your motor vehicle records or your Social Security records, they wouldn't process you and put you on the rolls. So, for example, I have a hyphenated last name. If I filled out my voter registration form without the hyphen, then Georgia would not put me on the rolls, but again, put me in abeyance, and then I have to prove that I am indeed the person with the hyphen that's in my voter driver's registration data. So Ohio and Georgia are two, prominent examples of how states are really making it hard to even start the process of getting registered to vote.
So, for example, were that to happen to you when you went to the polls to vote yourself and they found a hyphen missing and contested your right to vote, would you be able to vote as a provisional voter and then prove your case and then have your vote counted? I mean, at that moment in the polls when the election judge says to you, you're not qualified, what are your options?
Right. So in the case in Georgia, my name wouldn't appear because they didn't process my voter registration. So, yes, I should be offered a provisional ballot and be able to vote, and I should be told how what I need to do to ensure that that provisional ballot counts. And that's another piece, because not all poll workers provide that process. And then depending on the state, I have a certain number of days in which to return to the election official's office to prove that I am who I say I am and that I am eligible. And as you can imagine, there are many voters who, after the election is over and the results are called, don't make that extra step of going back to prove that they are indeed eligible.
Yeah, that's a big onus for the voter herself. For example, in Los Angeles, just a week or so ago when they had their primary, there are about 118,000 people in Los Angeles County who were excluded from the voting rolls. Most or all of them voted as provisional voters, and then, you know, putatively their votes were counted. Have you taken a look, your organization, the Voting Rights Project at Lawyers Committee, into that particular occurrence? I mean, why was it that that many people were left off the rolls in Los Angeles County?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that we are trying to get to the bottom of. As you know, we run the 866 Our Vote hotline. And so last Tuesday, we were getting calls from voters in Los Angeles County saying, I voted in 2016. I'm now showing up, and they're telling me they can't find my information. And so after the election, we did reach out to the LA County Recorder with a series of questions, asking them to let us know what happened, and more importantly, what they're doing to prevent it from happening again in November.
We should mention that the Election Protection Hotline is live and available to assist voters. It's in four different languages, English, Spanish, Asian languages, and Arabic. And we'll post that number on our website if you have any questions or if you have any problems when you vote in any state in the United States. Ms. Johnson-Blanco, in terms of the effects of the case called Shelby versus Holder, this is Shelby County versus Eric Holder, the former attorney general. This was a Supreme Court case back in 2013, which by people who opposed the ruling say that it gutted the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 and parts of Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which required that certain states with a history of voter discrimination be pre-cleared by a federal body, by the Justice Department. So that was overturned. Those parts of the Voting Rights Act were overturned by the Supreme Court. So it's now been, you know, that's 2013. We had an election in 14 and 16, and we have one coming up now in November of this year. To your reckoning, what has been the effect of that Supreme Court decision on these last two cycles, and how do you think it will affect the cycle we're about to enter?
Yes, I certainly agree with those who say that the Supreme Court in the Shelby County versus Holder decision gutted the Voting Rights Act. And what it has meant is that there are states that, as you noted, with the history of discrimination, no longer have to get federal approval. So what we saw, for example, in Texas passed a very restrictive voter ID law, a law that the courts found had a discriminatory impact and was intentionally discriminatory. And the trial court found it intentionally discriminatory. That law would not have been in effect had the Supreme Court not nullified a very important provision of the Voting Rights Act. In Georgia, where we see that they're moving to consolidate polling places in predominantly minority communities, they would not be able to do that had Section 5 of the Voting Rights still have been in effect. So what we're seeing is that these jurisdictions that were properly under the Voting Rights Act and had to have their laws approved by the federal government are passing laws that are making it harder to vote.
The National Commission on Voting Rights issued a report back in 2014, and they studied the years between 1995 and 2014. They did find that voting discrimination based on race is a frequent and ongoing problem. States that were formerly covered in the South and Southwest, like Texas, you mentioned, as well as Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, have remarkably high levels of documented voter discrimination. And we see that voter discrimination happens in a variety of forms. The Voting Rights Project that you co-direct is involved in a number of litigations with states all over the country, not all in the South. What is the prospect for any of these things, for legal remedies to be found to address the voter discrimination that your report found 4 years ago?
Well, we've been actively using another provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which states you can discriminate or dilute the vote. And we've been using that provision actively in litigation. The difference between Section 2 and Section 5 that we were talking about is that the law can still be in effect while it's being challenged. And so what we're finding is that there are hundreds of thousands of voters who are not able to vote while we're doing this litigation. So, but we will continue because we have the Section 2 remedy. And voter education also becomes a major part of what we do. And the Election Protection Hotline, the 866 Our Vote, is one vehicle through which we're doing a lot of voter education. And so, for example, in light of the Supreme Court's decision yesterday, now it's really important that voters verify their voter registration before going to the polls so they don't get an awful surprise thinking, oh, I registered, I voted in the last election, I'm good, I'm just going to show up and vote. Now the onus is now more on the voter to make sure that the system is doing what it should so when they show up to vote, they can.
And, of course, in North Carolina, there was another ruling by the Supreme Court last week, the one of three rulings concerning North Carolina voting that's happened at the Supreme Court in the last couple of months, actually. And they found that there was, in fact, racially tinged voting rights discrimination cases or discrimination occurring in North Carolina. One of the suggestions in the complainants in that case was to hold a special election. They denied that, but they did send back to the lower courts a decision that said, you know, you've got to take a look at the fact that there is, in fact, discrimination here. As we finish up real quickly here in North Carolina, is that that's one of these different kinds of ways that that people are discriminated against. What's your feeling about what happened in that case?
Right, and you're alluding to the redistricting cases and the way the lines are being drawn to prevent voters from being able to vote and vote for their candidates of choice, which is another issue that we are dealing with. And, you know, I would mention also North Carolina, that's also where the federal appeals court found that their laws were passed with surgical precision to discriminate. And so we're currently in an era where we really have to ask, you know, how much of a discriminatory impact is the Supreme Court willing to accept? And yesterday's decision and the Shelby County's decision is suggesting that the Supreme Court is going to allow voting discrimination, and we voting rights advocates just have to keep fighting and making the case and showing the record that discrimination is happening. And I'll say lastly that we can't leave Congress out of this equation. Congress can address this. They can make it clear, restore the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, and clarify the intent of the National Voter Registration Act.
Marcia Johnson Blanco is the co-director of the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Ms. Johnson Blanco, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Going to take a quick break. When we return, more on voting. For example, we've got an email from Peggy who says, in Australia, a child is registered to vote at birth. All Australians are required to vote, and if they don't, they got to pay a fine. They may submit a blank vote, but they have to present themselves at the voting place to avoid the fine. This practice eliminates the special voting block problem that we have. We'll talk about that and other solutions to these kinds of problems after a quick break with a scholar from the Brennan Center for Justice and another from the University of Baltimore. You're welcome to join our conversation when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org to send us a tweet at @midday_WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us on Midday. By the way, tomorrow on our program, tomorrow is the day before early voting begins in the primary. So we will preview the election with political reporters Pamela Wood of the Baltimore Sun, William Zorzi of Maryland Matters, and Ovita Wiggins of the Washington Post. That's coming up tomorrow. And this programming note, 2 weeks from tonight, I'll anchor live coverage of primary night in Maryland with the WIPR news team and several guest commentators. We'll be with you from 9 to 11 on election night right here on 88.1 WIPR. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about voting, who votes and who doesn't and why. Max Feldman joins us now. He serves as counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law in New York. He's the co-author of a fascinating new report outlining the increased difficulties that voters in nearly half of states throughout the country will face when they vote this year compared with prior years. Max Feldman joins us from NPR's New York studios. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with me here in Studio A is John Willis. He was Maryland's Secretary of State from 1995 to 2003. Part of his portfolio was overseeing elections here in Maryland. He chaired Maryland's Special Committee on Voting Systems and Election Procedures, which led to landmark legislation and implementation of election reform measures back in 2001. And he served on the commission to revise the election code, which modernized and recodified Maryland's election laws. He's now executive in residence at the University of Baltimore's School of Public and International Affairs. John, welcome back.
It's good to be with you, and all the voters should feel good about being in Maryland.
Yeah. We'll talk about the difference between Maryland and some of the other states. If you'd like to be part of our conversation about voting, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @midday_WIPR. So, John, let's pick that up. We have, all of these cases in front of courts at various levels in many states across the country. But Maryland, I mean, how would you assess Maryland's position when it comes to accessibility of voting, ease of voting, numbers of people who are voting in elections? What do you think?
Well, in terms of the structure and process, we're very good. It's easy to register. You have online ability to do that. You have fairly easy access for volunteer groups and others to participate. We've, in fact, driven our numbers up over the last decade or so in terms of the percentage of people, of voting eligible people that are registered. So we've done a pretty good job on that, and it's pretty easy in Maryland. Voting opportunities, we have absentee voting, we have 80 hours of early voting. Much of the litigation is from states like North Carolina and Ohio, where they're trying to restrict the number of hours. We've actually expanded the number of hours over the last decade. Voter restoration in terms of people who have been formerly incarcerated having the ability to vote, even though the governor here vetoed it. The legislature overrode that veto, and now it's very simple. You're either in correctional facility or not. So voter restoration, we're good. In terms of provisional voting, we're among the best in the country in terms of try to cast a provisional ballot in Ohio. You have to be in your same precinct for it to even count. In Maryland, you can be anywhere in the state and cast a provisional ballot and have your vote for the offices for which you're qualified counted, meaning your statewide votes will count. Those provisional ballot rules are very good and provide opportunity for voters to get a vote cast.
And Max Feldman,
turnout's a different question.
Yeah, that is a different question, and that's not a problem necessarily that's unique to Maryland by any means. But Max Feldman, in this report that you've issued recently, you identified 23 states that have requirements that make it more difficult to vote than it was back in 2010. Give us an overview of how that's the case.
That's right. So in the upcoming election, there will be at least 8 states that have passed new voter restrictions since just the last election. And as you've alluded to, this is part of a longer-term trend. Following the 2010 wave election, we saw a shift in the approach to election regulation in many states. So now 23 states have enacted restrictions that make it harder to vote than it was in 2010. So as Secretary Willis identified, some of the issues are cutbacks to early voting or more onerous voter registration burdens. But the most common of these new restrictions are strict voter ID laws. These are laws that require voters to present one of a short list of government-issued photo IDs in order to vote and don't offer a reasonable alternative to the many Americans who don't possess these types of IDs. So these types of restrictions have spread across the country and do make it more difficult for people when they go to the polls.
John Willis, we have here in Maryland a very unique situation in the Democratic primary for governor, in which one of the candidates, Valerie Ervin, was a former lieutenant governor candidate with Kevin Kamenetz, the former county executive of Baltimore County, who passed away suddenly on the 10th of May. She made a petition to have her name on the ballot instead of Mr. Kamenetz's, with her running mate, a woman named Marisol Johnson. That winded its way through the courts relatively quickly, and the court in Anne Arundel County decided that no, Ms. Ervin, it was just too late and too much of a burden on the Election Commission to change the ballots at this late hour to list Kamenetz Johnson, or excuse me, to list Ervin Johnson as opposed to Kamenetz Ervin. So voters who do choose to vote for Valerie Ervin for governor can fill in the oval for Kamenetz Ervin, and that vote will count for Valerie Ervin. But as a person who's overseeing elections, first of all, have you ever seen anything like this happen? And what do you think of the ruling of the court and how we move forward?
Well, it's a very difficult situation because, and yes, there have been other candidates that have died. In fact, Delegate Sophocles died over the weekend, and his name is still on the ballot running for House of Delegates in Anne Arundel County. So it happens. And this one was particularly unusual. We've never had a gubernatorial candidate that this has happened to in the history of Maryland politics in primaries since 1915. And the other thing is we have a federal law that requires ballots to be available to overseas voters 45 days before the election. But on the other hand, the Maryland statute, which was written before the Federal Move Act was written years ago, gives Valerie up to 40 days prior to the election in which to make a decision about whether to replace Kamenetz or to choose another gubernatorial. So the timing of the conflict between the federal
conflict
act,
between the statutes,
the
yeah.
federal act and the state act put her in a position. And also the voting, the instrument of voting we use, ballots were printed. Had you had other types of equipment, you could have made an easier accommodation. Say you had some ballot marking devices, which you could have electronically changed the names a lot quicker than you could if you're printing millions of ballots.
And Max Feldman, what do you think about that? The systems that we use, and of course they differ from state to state because the states are in charge of that, not the federal government, but paper ballots versus paperless balloting systems. What's your take on the current state of those and in particular how secure they are?
That's a great question, and it's one of the issues that we identify as a concern in the lead up to this election. As most of your listeners probably know, Russian agents attempted to disrupt our voting systems last election and to manipulate our elections. According to the Senate Intelligence Committee, Russian agents targeted voting systems in 18 states and were able to breach voter registration systems in a small number of states. We expected states to act quickly and urgently to address these problems and upgrade their voting systems. But unfortunately, several states have come up short. Too many use paperless electronic voting machines that don't leave a reliable paper trail that can be audited after an election to confirm vote tallies. And a second corollary problem to that is that too few states mandate these types of post-election audits to compare the paper record to the electronic vote count to ensure that there's been no manipulation.
We have an email from Gene who says, I have to say that a problem in Maryland's primary is that in order to vote, you must be either a registered Democrat or a Republican. I think this is ridiculous. So, John Lewis, we just saw in California where they have so-called open primaries. Some people call them jungle primaries, where everybody throws their hat in the ring and the top two vote-getters are on the election, the general election ballot following the primary. What's your take on that system as opposed to the Democratic primary system and the Republican primary system, which indeed leaves out people who are registered independents or with another party?
Yeah, we do have a system in Maryland, have had for centuries a closed, or since 1915, a closed primary system where you have to be registered with the party prior 21 days prior to the election in order to cast a vote for that. So there is opportunity for people to switch, and people do switch. Many other states have open primaries where you can just request on the day of the election. The top two system in California, I'm not a fan of, because the top two system kind of makes the parties somewhat irrelevant, and you could end up in the general election when many more people vote with only candidates of one party. So I'm not a particular fan of top two voting.
I know in California, a lot of Democrats were worried that that was going to happen. It looks like it didn't happen. Let's go to the phones. Dick in Baltimore, you want to call on this topic. I guess you're a registered independent. What's your take?
Yeah, and one of your guests said early on that the voters in Maryland should be happy to be living in Maryland, and I'm not because of that fact. I have always been an independent. I moved here 40 years ago and have been independent ever since. And this state is so gerrymandered, I don't have really good options in the general election because you can't vote for the predominant party, the Democrats, in the primary. And that's where most of the elections are decided in this state, or in the primaries, because the top Democratic candidate is the one who is most likely to win. I don't understand. I mean, I do understand why it is the way it is. I just think it gives too much power to the parties, and the independents should be given more of a say in who actually gets to run in the general.
So you would support, for example, the kind of system that they have in California where the top two vote-getters of either party would end up on the general election ballot?
No, I'm more in favor of having an independent able to go into a polling place and choose, if we're going to keep the two-party system the way it is, and choose which party's ballot they want to make their choices on.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the call, Dick. And I guess that was the case, at least with the Republican Party here in Maryland at one time.
They tried that for one presidential cycle, and other states do it. But the solution for those of your listeners that want that is a legislative solution. The Maryland General Assembly can change the way the eligibility requirements for our party primary system.
And Max Feldman, when it comes to security, back to the Russians and the vulnerabilities that we discovered in 2016, what, in your estimation, is the best solution? Are paperless ballots or systems that don't have a paper backup system just dangerous, and should they be simply abandoned, completely because of that?
Yeah, well, we do believe that states should be using voting machines that leave a reliable paper trail. And Congress recently invested about $380 million, appropriated about $380 million to help states upgrade their voting systems. This represents the most significant federal investment in state election security since 2002. So we at the Brennan Center are trying to help states figure out how best to invest that money. And we do believe that states who are using these vulnerable electronic voting systems should try to replace them. Unfortunately, it's likely a bit late in the game for the 2018 election, although it's not impossible. Last year, 2017, Virginia replaced its vulnerable electronic voting systems just 2 months before its election. But it is, realistically speaking, fairly late in the game for 2018. But states should be looking ahead to 2020. And in terms of what states can do before this election, they can pass bills to mandate post-election audits for states that do have paper voting machines. They can also implement basic security protocols, like making sure they have strong passwords. And election officials have to engage in rigorous contingency planning just in case there are problems in 2018 to make sure they know what they're going to do to address them.
Let's go to the phones again. Christina in Sparks, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You're on the line.
I am so impressed with Australia's system. My question is, what would it take to have that happen here? That's perfect. You have to vote or you get fined. I love it.
John Willis.
Maryland General Assembly, you need enough 73 votes in the 72 votes in the House of Delegates and 24 votes in the state Senate.
Okay, so this could be done on a state by state basis. And would there be a federal requirement?
Voter qualifications are really state by state.
Mm-hmm.
They're
so
in
Maryland
the state
could,
constitutions.
In fact, our legislature could pass a law that says if you don't vote, we're going to get slapped with a fine.
They could put voter qualifications into the state constitution and state statutes.
Yeah, the other thing they could do, Max Feldman, is address the extreme gerrymandering that happens in our state and many other states. You spend a lot of time in this report talking about that. The U.S. Supreme Court is actually considering a case involving gerrymandering here in Maryland, and we may get a decision on that in just a few days. Where does that stand in the litigation around not only that case, but cases throughout the country?
So that's exactly right. The Supreme Court has two partisan gerrymandering cases before it that it's likely to issue decisions on shortly. One coming out of Maryland, where Democrats drew an extremely partisan map that locks in a massive advantage in the Maryland congressional delegation for Democrats, and one coming out of Wisconsin, where Republicans have drawn an extremely partisan gerrymandered map that gives them a massive advantage in the state assembly that's not correlated to the number of votes they receive. So we are looking for the Supreme Court to hopefully strike down these maps, which have the effect of diluting voters' power at the ballot box. And hopefully, in addition to striking them down, enunciating a clear standard for what types of maps are constitutional and which ones are unconstitutional so that map drawers who are going to have to engage in the redistricting process again following the 2020 census have a clear sense of what falls on the right and wrong side of the line.
And you also write in your report, Max Feldman, about the way so many maps are designed to favor Republicans. We talk about perhaps 2018 being a blue wave election, but you say that the Democrats would need to win by an awful lot in order to actually regain control of the House of Representatives or even the Senate because of the way these gerrymandered districts are designed. It sounds like you're saying that it's sort of baked into the cake against Democrats in particular.
So that's right. I mean, taking a step back, this is a bipartisan problem. As you noted, Maryland has an extremely gerrymandered map that's before the Supreme Court, and that favors Democrats. But the way that things shook out after 2010 was that Republicans controlled more districts. They had the opportunity to draw more maps. So what ended up happening is that there's a built-in structural advantage in the House of Representatives that favors Republicans. And we put out a report indicating that Democrats would have to win by have an advantage of about 10 points nationwide in the vote total in order to obtain a simple majority in the House of Representatives. And there's some dispute about the exact number, but suffice it to say that Democrats will have to well outperform their vote total in order to achieve just a simple majority in the House of Representatives. And that's obviously not a good indicator of the health of our democracy, and it makes it more difficult for voters to hold their politicians accountable for their actions.
And John Willis, here in Maryland, the case involves just one district, the 6th Congressional District, that was changed under Governor Martin O'Malley. There's another case in Wisconsin that it talks about the statewide map. When I've talked to people who are running for the state Senate and people who are running for office here in Maryland, they say that coming up in January of 2019, the number one issue on people's minds in the legislature is going to be redrawing districts, because, of course, that happens with a census coming up in just a couple of years. What are the chances? What's your take on the political fire behind the idea of redoing how districts are drawn?
Well, I think there's some merit to the concept of impartial line drawing, and other states have experimented, whether it's by appointing different commissions or whatever. But the governor really has the authority under the Maryland Constitution to do that. He really doesn't need to implement any new laws. The Maryland Constitution gives the authority on the state legislative side to the governor to draw the map, and he can do that process any way he wants to do it in terms of seeking input. So the governor really controls the legislative process. If the legislature doesn't like what the governor did, then the legislature can override that, which has never happened in Maryland since we've had that constitutional provision. On the congressional side, that is a straight legislative process, meaning that it's up to the Maryland General Assembly right now to draw those lines. And the General Assembly could itself decide that they wanted to seek outside advice or independent reaction. There are lots of methods or suggestions out there, and I expect we'll see some progress on that over the next decade.
John Willis was Maryland's Secretary of State from 1995 to 2003. He's now executive in residence at the University of Baltimore's School of Public and International Affairs. Max Feldman joins us from New York. He's the co-author of The State of Voting 2018, a publication of the Brennan Center for Justice. More with Max Feldman and John Willis, and when we return after a quick break, Nike Robinson will join us. She's the founder of Black Girls Vote, a Baltimore-based organization that encourages young women of color to be politically engaged. If you'd like to engage with Midday here, talking about voting, our phone number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Good afternoon. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Early voting in the Maryland primary begins Thursday, the day after tomorrow. And today we're talking about barriers to voting and what can be done to get more people to vote. Former Maryland Secretary of State John Willis and Max Feldman of the Brennan Center for Justice in New York join me in a little bit. We're going to hear from Nike Robinson from Black Girls Vote. But first, if you'd like to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org to send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWIPR. Max Feldman, ranked voting is something that they're voting on today in the state of Maine. It's used in a couple of other jurisdictions, a lot of local jurisdictions, San Francisco, the city of San Francisco, for example. Can you explain how ranked voting works and whether or not you think it's a good idea?
Well, I think we are in favor of, states experimenting and trying to figure out what works best for their states. Ranked voting allows voters, instead of just choosing one candidate, to sort of rank the candidates in order of their preference. And then there's something called an instant runoff. And it's something that is taking off in certain states and could be an interesting experiment. We'll have to see how it comes out and how voters like it.
John Lewis, or Willis, what do you think?
I actually have covered this issue extensively. I write a newsletter called An Election Administration Reports every 2 weeks, and we follow the ranked choice voting and have since its inception, both the very interesting race in Minneapolis. Today's race in the Maine for governor is going to be quite interesting.
And the way it works, just to give folks an idea, how does it happen?
And we actually did this in Maryland in the 1930s, so it's not that new. You go in, and instead of just making one choice for governor, you would have an an opportunity to rank the candidates. This is my second choice. This is my third choice. This is my fourth choice, to whatever many you want, depending on the rules of the state and the rules of the laid out in the legislation. Then the lowest finishers would drop off, and their votes, say your candidate dropped off, that candidate's second choices would then be reallocated to the other candidates. So the numbers could change. The person that had
So if not enough people were ranked first, right, they'd be out of the deal.
Correct. And then so you can accumulate votes by being other people's second and third vote choices. The idea is to ultimately get to a majority. Someone will ultimately end up with 50 plus one.
And Max Feldman, given the fact that the voting habits of U.S. voters are frankly terrible, of the top 40 democracies in the world, we are usually in the bottom five in terms of turnout and participation. We were number 26 the last time this was figured out in between 2014 and 2016. Belgium is first. They have nearly 90% of their voters voting. But we just have, you know, many fewer than that. In the last midterm election in 2014, 70% of eligible voters didn't vote in the midterm elections. It's enormous. So does ranked voting put this extra onus on people to not only understand who their first candidate is, but their second, their third, their fourth, and down the line? What do you think in terms of what it does to the psyche of voters who apparently are reluctant to cast their vote anyway?
That's a great question. I'm honestly not sure exactly how it will affect the psyche of voters. I mean, I think you've hit on a really important point, though, which is that we need to get people more excited about voting generally. And we also need to make sure that people can get on the rolls easily and that they can vote easily. So one of the key reforms that we identify in our report that we think is particularly important is called automatic voter registration. And that's where if you can go and interact with a government agency, you are automatically registered to vote unless you affirmatively decline, and your information is electronically transferred from that government agency to election officials. It's a very seamless and straightforward process, and it gets more people on the rolls and has been proven to improve turnout. And actually, Maryland just enacted an automatic voter registration law this year. So there are a variety of ways and reforms that states can undertake to get people onto the rolls, excited about voting, and turning out to vote.
Max Feldman is with the Brennan Center for Justice in New York. Former Maryland Secretary of State John Willis has also joined me. Gentlemen, I thank you very much. I very much appreciate it, and we'll stay in touch. Thank you.
It's good to be with you.
Thanks so
much. Everybody vote.
Okay, everybody vote indeed, and we're now going to talk to a person who's doing a Herculean effort to get that to happen. Nike Robinson joins us. She's the founder of Black Girls Vote. That's a Baltimore-based organization that encourages young women of color to vote and to be engaged with the political process. She is on the line from New York, where she happens to be today. Nike, welcome back to Midday.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
Well,
it's been too long.
Delighted to have you, and I'm sorry it has been a long time. We tend to talk to you only around election times, but so you're working on a new initiative, trying to figure out how to increase voter participation. What you got going?
Sure, absolutely. As you know, we're out on the ground trying to get more people involved in the political process, especially our young women who are 18 to 25-year-olds. So what we understand is that we have to make voting cool, and we have to meet them where they are. So this year we are excited that we're working with Be More Votes and Vote Together and Party to the Polls. So that means on Election Day this year, we're working with the C groups to say, hey, come out and vote. But then it'll be interactive. There's going to be a resource fair held on June 21st at Westside Chapman Center. And then there's also going to be one at Carter G. Woodson on the 16th of June. So there'll be activities, resource fairs, and things like that happening. We're also excited that we are partnering with a ride sharing company. We did it in 2016. We're finalizing the details there about getting folks to the polls where you can use your discount codes, because we know that folks nowadays like to use technology. And whether you're going to the polls, whether you need to pick up your kids from daycare, whether you just need to run to the grocery store, or it's so that it's your day is more convenient, we're going to be offering a code through Black Girls Vote so that you can get to the polls or wherever you have to go on election day to make it convenient. So we understand that it's about engaging, educating, and empowering women of color to get out and vote, but knowing that your vote has so much value and your vote is your voice. So we're excited.
Are people more interested by your reckoning? I mean, do you think that there is more excitement and more interest in being involved in the political process here in 2018, given the results of the election in 2016?
You know what? Interestingly enough, I think folks are angry, but they aren't necessarily channeling that energy to actively going out and voting. Even right now, this week, we aren't getting as much, you don't hear as much about the election as we would like or hope, or folks getting excited and engaged with early voting. That's a big deal. As we know, it helps increase our overall election results. So that's one of the things that we're hoping to do, folks, you know, saying, hey, this election matters. It starts locally, statewide, and nationally. So we're working on it, but it goes back and forth. So in some ways, yes, but then we also hear some folks who are turned off by it and discouraged. So we see a mixture of both, but we are extremely, extremely optimistic and excited about what's to come.
Is early voting an option that you find particularly appealing? I mean, is it more appealing, less appealing, neutral when, in terms of Election Day voting?
No, I think it depends who you are. A lot of us who are on the grounds on Election Day, you have so many things to do, so it may not be as convenient. As we know, with early voting, you have choices, and we like to have options where you can go to any of the locations, primarily in Baltimore City or wherever you are, to vote, and that's something that's extremely convenient. I think that the more and more we see that, the more increase you'll see of voting, because it gives you a range, particularly with women of color who are often heads of their households or things like that. They may not be able to commit just one day to do it, depending on what their day looks like. So here we have an entire week where, hey, if you can't do it this day, you can do it this day. But please, please, please make sure you get out to vote. I understand there are decisions that are being made every single day by policy, by the people who we put in office. So please exercise your right to vote.
There are 7 early voting centers in the city of Baltimore. There are 7 in Anne Arundel County. There are 11 in Baltimore County. There are 2 in Carroll County. So there are places all over the state where people can exercise their right to vote early if they choose. But Nike, I mean, bottom line here is you're doing everything you can to make it easy. You're doing everything you can to make it, as you say, cool. Some parties and some, perks that come with voting. Why do you think it is that for a lot of people, particularly young people, it seems, if the polls are to be believed, it's just not something that they feel is an important civic duty, or something that they feel, I guess, is going to have much of an impact? Why can't the act of voting itself be sort of elevated and more felt more cherished and precious than it is?
You know, I honestly think it's a case by case, and it's culturally as well. Some may not see, you know, their parents actively saying, "Hey, voting's important. Let me get out to vote," or having those around the table conversations. We don't have those during dinner time, and I think really when we use the power of social media and folks saying, "Hey, I voted. It's cool," then it's almost like it has to be a trend, and we haven't quite gotten there yet. And I think in 2008 and 2012, we saw that it was a trend to vote. However, we didn't have as much young individuals on social media as we do today. So I think the more and more we get celebrities involved, we get people of influence talking about how voting is cool, come party and vote at the polls, as I said, with Vote Together, so many things that it's like, oh, you know what, maybe I will vote. And then they'll start talking about the issues more. But we have to tie in the issues and then knowing that, hey, your vote has power, and this is what voting does. And with civics not being in the schools any longer, a part of the curriculum, there are so many things that folks are removed from because they are, what I see, are trying to figure out their everyday hustle and bustle. How do I pay my bills? I have to take care of my siblings, or I have to take care of my children, or I have to figure this out, that there are so many other things happening. That we see people are exhausted, they're tired, they're frustrated. And so voting for them, on the other end, they hear all the time different rhetoric. It doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. And they don't have the time, nor right now, honestly, the interest to dive into the details. So it's up to us and, you know, people like you who are creating a platform for, you know, folks to hear about what's going on so that it can personally resonate with them. And I think once it resonates with them, then that's when we'll start to see a change. So there's a lot of work to be done. There are a lot of groups on the ground who are doing the work. And I think over time, we will definitely see an increase in voter registration and turnout in our elections. So now I'm extremely hopeful.
Nike Robinson, she's the founder of Black Girls Vote, and we'll have information about joining Black Girls Vote and getting hip to their events on our website, wypr.org/midday. Thanks, Nike. I appreciate it.
thank you, Tom, and look out. We'll be launching some things soon about voting day, right to the polls.
Okie doke. Looking forward to it. We also want to mention, if you do vote early, you can register and vote on the spot. You don't have to be pre-registered to vote if you go to an early voting location. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. They've got locations and hours at joesquared.com. Out of the Blocks with Aaron Henkin is up next after the news at the top of the hour. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about all the big races with three terrific reporters. We hope you can join us tomorrow on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening today. Have a great day.